happen if you build a refuge for a persecuted people in a place where another people already lived. In the next few minutes, you'll learn why this moral quandary is at the root of the struggle between Israelis and Palestinians, and what you can do to help achieve a just peace for everyone in the region. First, there are a couple of things it's helpful to understand. One, many Jews fled harsh persecution in anti-Semitic Europe, especially the Nazi Holocaust. Zionists encouraged massive immigration to historic Palestine, at that time a British colony, where Jews had an age-old connection and where small Jewish communities had long existed among larger groups of indigenous peoples. But when the UN offered the Jewish immigrants the majority of the land for a new state called Israel, for the indigenous Palestinians who lived there, it was a massive destruction of life. They rejected the UN's partition plan, and several Arab states invaded the new state of Israel. Israeli forces essentially erased over 400 Palestinian villages and towns. By the end of the fighting, Israel controlled 78% of historic Palestine. And when 750,000 Palestinians who fled or were expelled during fighting tried to return to their homes where the new state now stood, they were permanently barred by the Israeli government. While over 100,000 of their relatives and neighbors who hadn't left became second-class citizens of the new state, along with the new Jewish majority. Today, Palestinian refugees and their descendants number in the millions. Most are in the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and Jordan. Many are spread throughout the world, with millions still living in refugee camps, seeking to return to their homeland. To sum up, one group of refugees found a much-needed home. But in the process, a new group of refugees was created. Here's the second thing to understand. Israel was founded as a Jewish state. But now ask yourself, what exactly does that mean? People had lots of ideas about what a Jewish state should look like. Some called for equality for all citizens. But what was created, in practice, was institutional discrimination against non-Jews. In other words, Israel ended up being built on a blueprint of exclusion. The Israeli government wants maximum land and resources for Jews, but not the Palestinians living there. That's why, inside Israel, Jews get special privileges, including rights to land and housing that are denied to the Palestinian citizens, who make up 20% of Israel's population. That's also part of why Israel has never defined its borders. In fact, they still hold on to land, the West Bank and Gaza, that they conquered in the war in 1967. Since then, Israel has built Jewish settlements throughout the occupied West Bank, building Jewish-only cities and supplying them with infrastructure like roads and army camps, schools, and even a college. Military occupations are meant to be temporary. But after 40-plus years, this one looks permanent and entirely unjust. In the West Bank, Israeli Jewish settlers and Palestinians live on the same land but must live under two completely separate and unequal systems of Israeli law. The Jewish settlers dominate the natural resources, including water and agricultural land, and they're backed by the Israeli army. To maintain the occupation, Israel has demolished thousands of Palestinian homes and orchards, confiscated Palestinian land, bombed a captive civilian population in Gaza, and punished resistance with raids, arrests, and assassinations, all to gain maximum land while making life so difficult for Palestinians that they will either leave or be too afraid to resist. Palestinians have fought back. For decades, they tried to achieve national liberation through armed struggle. Some groups still do. But the majority now support popular protest instead. The deeply harmful pattern of control, repression, and violence profoundly harms Palestinians living under occupation and Israelis living as occupiers. This must be broken to reach a peaceful and secure future for both peoples. Now that you understand the problem, what about the solution? What about peace talks? So far, over two decades of U.S.-backed peace talks have actually made things worse by helping Israel continue the occupation. It's been years of talking while Israel massively expanded the Jewish settlements and literally redrew the map. Peace talks are good if they're real, but not when they're theater to cover a land grab. So now what? The current world superpower, the United States, has been a terrible friend, enabling Israel's destructive and self-destructive expansion onto Palestinian land by funding the Israeli military, the biggest recipient of U.S. foreign aid in the world. But there's another superpower that can make the difference. You. There's a movement with hundreds of thousands of people just like you across the world, including Palestinians and Israelis, protesting, educating, divesting, and boycotting, all to bring nonviolent international pressure on Israel to stop violating human rights of Palestinians. Throughout history, where governments have failed to push for justice, people just like you, like us, have taken the lead and won. Now it's the Palestinians' turn for freedom and justice. We can pressure Israel to end the occupation and the discrimination. We want all people, Jews and Palestinians, to have equality, human rights, and democracy. We can change history. Join us.
When 20 million were slaughtered by Nazi invasion, they died fighting on our side, you know, in a fight to defend humankind against Nazi terror and hatred. In the name of humanity, bitterly torn, in the name of our children as yet to be born, before we do that which can never be undone, I beg of you, think again, and again, and again, and again, and again. The Russians want war. These are the parents of children who died in the last one. Do you think that they'd want to go through that again? The destruction, the bloodshed, the suffering and pain. In the Second World War, out of every three dead, one was Russia. Try with all of our power, can we not find a way to peacefully settle our difference? In the name of humanity, bitterly torn, in the name of our children as yet to be born, before we do that which can never be undone, I beg of you, and again, and again, and again, and again. Do you think that the Russians want war? Will the voice of insanity lead you to total destruction? Will you stumble to death as though you were blind? Will you cause the destruction of all humankind? Will you die because you don't like their political system? There will be no survivors, you know, no one left to scream in the night and condemn our stupidity. In the name of humanity, bitterly torn, in the name of our children as yet to be born. Before we do that, which can never be undone, I beg of you, think again. And again, and again, and again, and again.
The fact is that to an extraordinary extent, by comparative standards, the United States is a business-run society, which means that human rights are subordinated to the overwhelming, overriding need of profit for investors. Decisions are placed in the hands of unaccountable private tyrannies, which means that even if formal democratic practices exist as they do, they're of peripheral significance. The government, in fact, is, as John Dewey called it 50 or 60 years ago, the shadow cast by business over society, so that modifications in the shadow are not going to change the substance. These were truisms throughout most of American history, including American working class history, until quite recently, until the 1950s, in fact. And it also means that social policy is geared to the transfer of wealth and power to those who already have it, and deliberately so. Now, in more democratic societies, by that I mean societies where democratic forms function more, there are countervailing forces that enable the public to enter the arena of policy and decision. That's only true to a very limited extent, a remarkably limited extent in the United States, despite quite impressive democratic forms.
I could be a soldier, go out there and fight to save this land. Be a people soldier, paramilitary.
And they stole. can tell you that when you get older, time seems to move ever more quickly. So it seems to me that it was only a week ago that we were gathered here in our thousands to shout out our no to war. And at that time, some very prominent commentators and politicians, many of whom would like now to forget what they said then, told us that we had it wrong. Just you wait, they say, it'll all work out. They told us that the United States troops and their allies will be welcomed into Iraq with grateful adulation. That peace and democracy would be brought to a land that had long groaned under dictatorship, and that this country would then act as a beacon to the rest of the region, that they would create a perfect model of a modern liberal democracy as a harbinger of the new Middle East. Well, that was then. Now we know nothing that they promised has been delivered. Everything that we warned against has come to pass, and worse. It is grotesque beyond words, in light of that experience, that George W. Bush should be asked and welcomed here to Belfast by the First Minister and Deputy First Minister, and allowed to present himself as a man who can consolidate peace on our own little patch of earth. What shame! What hypocrisy! As has been said to millions and millions of people all over the world, there is no dilemma, there is no confusion about what George Bush represents. We are told that not only will he help to consolidate peace here, but that he will act as a spur to economic investment and development in Northern Ireland. Even if that were true, we'd have to make a judgment about where the balance lay in deciding what attitude to take to him. But it is not true. That pledge is as worthless today as was the pledge made by Bush and his supporters about peace in the Middle East and peace in the world 5 years ago. They tell us that we must bow down to Bush because if we don't, investment won't come, that we won't have jobs. In the name of that, they are asking us to allow ourselves to be blackmailed. We should look more closely and see that what they are really saying is that we must do anything and everything that they demand because they are the masters of the universe. I would say this to people who think that they can have the political power of bilocation and be in two places at the same time. George Bush said 5 years ago, 6 years ago, he said, you're either with us or against us. I would say to those to whom it concerns, you can't be with us and simultaneously with him. The gap is too wide. You cannot straddle it. Even people of the most flexible principles cannot straddle that divide. It's make your mind up time, comrades. What side are you on? I say that we should be on the side of the plain people of the world. We're told often that we now live in a global village, and so we do. Well, if we live in a global village, the people of Iraq, the people of Palestine, the people of Afghanistan, the people of Lebanon, they are our neighbours. Their children are the children of our neighbours. And we should stand by them and not stand by George Bush. Strikes me, you know, that if Peter Robinson goes home tonight and discusses the events of the day with his family, we might hope that he will say, you know, Iris, you're right. There is an abomination loose upon the land, and I have looked into its eyes. is a cause here which transcends our differences. There is a cause here which transcends all national and ethnic differences on this earth. It is a cause of fighting to preserve our earth from the economic degradation being visited upon us when profit is the only lawgiver as to the way our world should develop. There is a cause which transcends everything else, of standing together with our neighbors against the evil which Bush represents. They have turned the Middle East into a jigsaw, exploding slowly in a downpour of blood. We say enough. They now say openly that they want to attack Iran. Bush hints that he might attack Iran before the end of his presidency, which can't come soon enough because the American people have done with him, and we shouldn't be welcoming a man that the American people themselves have done with him. But make no mistake, the fight against war, the fight against what Bush represents, will continue even after Bush's presidency. And we have got to stand ready to defend ourselves against the suggestion that we should turn Northern Ireland into a shiny little fragment of their new order. We should stand up for ourselves through the trade union movement for the rights of workers. And we should stand up for ourselves as a people who know war and who crave peace and who know who is the warmonger in our midst. Tell Bush today, go home. You're not wanted here. And what's more, Mr. Bush, you're not even wanted at home. Thank you very much.
But most wars by imperialist cultures, i.e. the white cultures of this world, are fought against brown-skinned people, especially the ones who sit on top of most of the oil. And 2 million people, a massive amount of people, marched in London, and another 15 to 50 million, whatever the figure was, marched across the world against the Iraq war, and all he could say was, "I understand how you feel." And that was that, fuck off, more or less. But instead of Thatcher would have said, "Fuck off, I'm going to war," Blair would say, "I understand how you feel, but I'm doing the right thing." Basically doing what Bush tells them to, because they're all part of this fucking secret sect of fucking Bohemian Grove fuckwits who want to control the entire planet and get control of all the resources on it. Why, I do not know. He said, like, "Oh no, what, is it money you want? You know, have all the money in the world, print yourself billions and billions of dollars, they already got that, so it can't be money. You have all the power you want, you'll be President of the United States, biggest country in the world." Nope. Shit, they've already got that. So what the fuck do they want, you know what I mean? All they want is more oil to run all their fucking SUVs in order to make more money. And then they've already got the money, so they're basically what they want. So I think they're in a league with the devil, or some fucking pact, or some sort of supernatural source, or they're just fucking complete bastards with no fucking soul whatsoever. I think that's the final conclusion we have to make. Which is why you have to stand up for what little rights are left over and sort of take control of your own life and get together with other people who are thinking the same thing before you start to think that I'm the only one left thinking anything different from what's being fed to me. What? What's the question?
Saw London burning, and during the war, my brother was killed, and many of my mates were killed. And when I came home to troop ship in the summer of 1945, I heard the words of the Charter of the United Nations. What it said was, we the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war which twice in our lifetimes has caused untold suffering to mankind. And that is what I believe in. And when we went to war for oil, which is what it was about, we tore up the Charter of the United Nations. It was an illegal war, an immoral war, and it's an unwinnable war. And we have to see that it stops, and it stops now. Now, I've spoken in Trafalgar Square many times about, I think I started at the time of the Suez War, and then I was here in 64 when Mandela was put in prison. But I've never in every campaign come to such a quick conclusion in one respect: the police are going to allow us to march. And that is a victory that you have achieved, and it's an enormously important victory. And as you go down past the cemetery, just think of all the guys who gave their lives so we have the right to go to Parliament. And we are the people who put them there. They are not the people who tell us what we can say and what we can do. And I say one other word. I have 10 grandchildren. Oh my God, from all over the world. I've got 2 Indian grandchildren, another one's in love with a Punjabi lawyer, another one's in love with a black American doctor, my wife was an American, and so on and so on. I'm breeding the UN peacekeeping force in my own family. Comrades, I think of my grandchildren because they have a decision to make that no decision has ever been, ever previous generations had to make. With the technology at our disposal, we can destroy the human race. But if we use it, my God, to build hospitals and schools and houses, we can solve the problems of the human race. And that is the choice we have to make. And we start today. Get our troops out of Iraq. Bring them home. Out of Afghanistan. And you wait and see. Just as Nelson Mandela won, we're going to win this. Never have any doubts we're going to win. And if you want to know why, it's because you're here, not because I'm here. People always win. This is the People's Parliament here in Trafalgar Square, and we're well ahead of the Parliament we're going to visit now. Keep going. Thank you for listening.
What? So 2 days ago, Israel launched a bombing campaign dubbed Operation Protective Edge against Gaza that's still ongoing. But despite the horrors on the ground, the mainstream media seems to only be telling one side of the story. Take a look at this. From the Wall Street Journal, Israeli air defense intercepts more rockets as fighting continues. And the LA Times goes on to declare that Palestinian rockets reach farther into Israel. And lastly, the New York Times makes it seem like there's an equal playing field by stating Israel and Hamas simply exchange fire. Well, I guess I really can't expect more from a media apparatus that essentially works as stenographers for the U.S. government. Let's take a listen to what the issue is being framed by the White House.
We strongly condemn the continuing rocket fire into Israel and the deliberate targeting of civilians by terrorist organizations in Gaza. No country can accept rocket fire aimed at civilians, and we support Israel's right to defend itself against these vicious attacks. At the same time, we appreciate the call that Prime Minister Netanyahu himself has made publicly to act responsibly.
Wait, what? Acting responsibly? I must be in the Twilight Zone, because to me, the collective punishment of an entire population is the opposite of responsible. So, what's the reality on the ground? Well, just in the last 24 hours, Israeli forces have conducted airstrikes that have struck 160 sites in Gaza, according to the IDF. In total, 550 sites have been bombed. And considering the fact that Gaza is one of the most densely populated places on Earth, with over 1 million inhabitants, any aerial strike conducted in the region almost certainly means civilian deaths. In fact, at the time of this broadcast, the strikes have killed at least 53 Palestinians, including 8 children and an 80-year-old woman. According to the Palestinian Minister of Public Works and Housing, at least 50 homes have been destroyed so far and 1,700 damaged. So when the IDF talks about hitting, quote, Hamas targets, remember that Hamas is the democratically elected leadership of Gaza, which could mean any government building or social services for Palestinians. So while the U.S. government can go on and on about Israel's right to defend itself, take heed of the increasing death toll in Gaza and the fact that no Israelis have yet died as a result of Hamas rockets. Look, I denounce deadly force on both sides, but it's important to not frame this as a cycle of violence that's equal. One is the colonizer oppressor, the other, the colonized oppressed. As IDF General Son Miko Peled said just yesterday on the show, there are two choices for Palestinians in occupied territories: to completely surrender or resist. And resistance is what we're seeing now. I'm sick of my Palestinian friends losing their friends and family every time Israel goes on the offense against innocent people living in an open-air prison. So if demolishing homes, conducting mass arrests, and bombing civilians is, quote, responsible, I shudder to think how many people have to die in order to define irresponsibility.